for these patients where there's a chance, by definition, of them coming off dialysis, I think we owe it to them as a field to do everything we can to make sure we give them the best chance to come off.
I think even getting one patient off dialysis should be sufficient.
What's more important to a patient on dialysis than the opportunity to get off dialysis?
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks, and I'm here with two guests to talk about the second installment of the American Society of Nephrology's Kidney Health Guidance. This second guidance is on the outpatient management of patients with dialysis requiring acute kidney injury. We have two guests who are co-first authors and corresponding authors of this manuscript published in JASN. Dr. Anita Vijayan, who is at Intermountain Health in Salt Lake City. And we also have Dr. Michael Hung, who is at the University of Michigan. Welcome to both of you to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. Happy to have you both here.
My name is Anita Vijayan. I am the Senior Medical Director for Intermountain Health Kidney Services.
This is Mike Hung. I'm a nephrologist at the University of Michigan, where I serve as the clinical chief.
First things first, this is our second podcast on the ASN Kidney Health Guidance, and I'd like to hear about what exactly a health guidance is.
The purpose of the health guidance is to provide advice to practicing clinicians in a practical, real-world setting. So this is different than a guideline statement, which really focuses on the best possible evidence and takes quite a bit of time to put together. So the idea of a guidance is to be a little bit more of a streamlined document, again, to provide real pragmatic advice for clinicians practicing.
So like for a guideline, you might have different levels of evidence and a sort of a structured approach to it. This is a little different in that obviously you're looking at evidence, but also you're trying to make practical recommendations for people that are taking care of patients on the front line.
And unfortunately, this is an area where there isn't a ton of evidence. And so that's one of the other reasons we, you know, wouldn't call this a guideline, but mainly it's to streamline the process, to make this an agile kind of document that we can put together based on the current best practices and in a way that we hope helps people, but also hopefully helps the field move forward in this area.
This is a very frustrating area when you have a patient who is being discharged from the hospital after a severe illness, they have acute kidney injury, they're requiring dialysis. You're not 100% certain if they're going to recover, you think they might, and they're going into an environment with a new healthcare team that might not know exactly what to expect. So I want to bring this back to Dr. Vijayan. What did y'all do when you first sort of faced this very complicated issue, and how did you sort of formulate this guidance?
As we are all practicing nephrologists, we know that there's no clear guidance right now on how to do that transition between inpatient and outpatient nephrology and dialysis setting for a patient who continues to require dialysis. We've all had experience where patients have been sent to outpatient dialysis, accidentally labeled as having ESRD, and nobody's monitoring their kidney function for recovery. So what this guidance is strongly suggesting, and of course we cannot make recommendations, it's not a guideline, so we're strongly suggesting some practical points, which is to have a warm handoff between the inpatient and outpatient team. So what do we mean by that? The nephrologist should pick up the phone and call the outpatient nephrologist to say, hey, Mr. Smith is leaving this hospital tomorrow with the diagnosis of acute kidney injury. Give a background of the AKI diagnosis, comorbidities, the hospital course, and explain what their prognosis might be on the best clinical evidence to date. So as you read the guidance, you realize that we didn't really go into the phenotypes of AKI, but we went into the phenotypes based on chance for recovery of kidney function. And that's the main communication we want to get across to the outpatient team. Hey, this patient has a high likelihood of renal recovery based on X, Y, and Z, and we recommend monitoring certain things to make sure the patient achieves that renal recovery.
We can pause right there and just sort of talk about the approach to this guidance and what was the makeup of the group of individuals that came together to put this together.
Well, we felt it was very important to try to get as much different stakeholder involvement as possible. We knew early on that we had our perspective as nephrologists practicing on this side, both on the inpatient and on the outpatient side, but Obviously, we're not the only ones involved in the care. Everyone from the social workers on the inpatient side to dialysis nurses, technicians, pharmacists, we felt that it was very important to have representation from a variety of stakeholders. And of course, the patients are really important stakeholders, and they did have a role in reviewing the document as well to make sure that this resonated with them as well.
We also had representation from dialysis organization. One of the members was a chief quality officer.
Well, that sounds like you have a very wide perspective of individuals. And I think I want to start with the first question that when you're making that warm handoff, and to me, I'm sort of thinking, well, shouldn't this be happening for every patient on dialysis? And I guess that's the challenge, is hard to find the right person. And so the infrastructure probably needs to improve. But the main question that is being asked is, how do you know what the prognosis is for these patients? How did y'all go about helping the clinicians define that?
That's a great question. And the first thing we did was try to go to the literature and see what available data there was in the literature for specifically answering that question of understanding the likelihood of recovery or the kidney prognosis for these patients. And there have been a number of studies that have tried to develop different prediction models. We ended up deciding not to choose any particular model because most of these models have not had extensive validation. And so we did not feel that any one model was going to be a one-size-fits-all in terms of helping a clinician know the likelihood of recovery. However, we took the information from these different models, as well as just other published literature looking at risk factors for recovery, and we put together a broad framework that's covered in Table 2 of the Kidney Health Guidance, which separates people into three different groups: a high recovery phenotype, which we defined as greater than 30%, a moderate recovery group between 10 and 30% recovery, and a low recovery group where we thought that there was less than 10%. And so we provided some of the risk factors that would move people into one category or another, as well as some example scenarios of how to define those phenotypes. And I think very importantly, we wanted to err on the side of assuming recovery. One of the most important outcomes for us is, of course, recovery to dialysis independence, which has a better prognosis and, of course, a better quality of life for patients. So we felt like a guiding principle for this document was to err on the side of assuming recovery and, as I'm sure we'll talk about later, doing whatever we can to increase the odds of recovery for these patients.
Can you describe what are the main factors that you look at for that?
So patients who have significant other comorbidities, especially heart failure, liver failure, advanced malignancy, patients who are of advanced age, patients who have had severe underlying chronic kidney disease to begin with, so stage 4, stage 5 CKD at baseline, those tend to fall into the category that's less likely to recover kidney function. Younger person, patient with a sudden trauma, say in a car accident with rhabdomyolysis, those patients are more likely to recover kidney function. We did not specify any prognosis based on kidney biopsies because, as you know, majority of patients in the hospital with AKI are not getting kidney biopsies. So we didn't bring any pathology into our phenotyping. The other category is patients with prolonged acute kidney injury. So the severity of AKI and the duration of AKI also will affect recovery of kidney function.
I'm getting some really interesting ideas just thinking about this and having a discharge summary that kind of has this, like you click on which one it is and why that might be the case so that this information is being transmitted to the dialysis unit. It seems to be like a good approach here.
We also want to emphasize that patients with AKI also are at high likelihood for rehospitalization. They're higher risk for mortality compared to the ESRD patients. And also these patients tend to have significant other comorbidities. So the goals of care discussion is also an important part of the puzzle. Not every patient wants to go on long-term dialysis if their kidneys are not recovering. And therefore, we have to make sure that the goals of care discussion, if any, is also, that discussion is also transmitted to the outpatient nephrologist.
And that's a very good point. I'm going to pivot here to policy. And when I first saw this guidance, I had assumed this would have a lot of policy baked into it. Although there's some policy, there's not a lot. And the key piece I want to talk about is, I just want to hear what this group's approach to this was, is how you code a patient for ESRD versus AKI. Does that make any difference in how the patient might have reimbursement for receiving dialysis as an outpatient?
Yeah, great point about the policy. And frankly, one of the reasons we did not dive deeper into the policy within the guidance document is simply because of the fact that this is meant to be a clinical guidance. We do think that policy is really important, well, now and in the future, to help improve the care of this population. But ultimately, we felt that it was probably outside the scope of this guidance, where we wanted to focus on clinical suggestions. That said, we had a lot of robust discussions in the work group on policy-related aspects. And with regard to the question of reimbursement, right now, based on CMS policy and the law, the patients with AKI are reimbursed at the same rate as patients with end-stage kidney disease. So it doesn't really allow for any additional payment at this point, even though these patients probably require a lot more attention. And that's one of the things we really emphasize in this document, is how much more individualized care these patients need. So I think that is an issue in terms of coding the patients for end-stage kidney disease versus AKI. That's a can of worms, because there's a lot of different angles. I'll just touch on a couple. For one thing, as soon as you designate a patient as end-stage kidney disease, they will fall into the quality incentive program metrics. And for example, one of those metrics may be vascular access. And of course, most patients with AKI will have a dialysis catheter. And so the timing of making that switch can certainly affect a given unit's QIP scoring, which in turn affects reimbursement. So there's that angle. Conversely, another point is that if you haven't designated the patient end-stage kidney disease, you're keeping them as AKI, this may delay their certification for Medicare if they don't have a good insurance otherwise. And it also may delay other appropriate care if they aren't going to recover, such as transplant referral and transplant listing. There are considerations on both sides of that as to the timing of when to designate somebody as continued AKI versus end-stage kidney disease. And a lot of that does have to be individualized in our estimation.
And to follow up on that, so as we think about a patient going into outpatient dialysis, is their diagnosis acute kidney injury on admission, or is it ESKD on admission? It also affects how you round on them as well, right? So patients with end-stage kidney disease typically are rounded on by an APP, a nurse practitioner, or a physician once a week, and the maximum is usually 4 times a month. Whereas with acute kidney injury, if you follow the same model of rounding and taking care of these patients, that may delay recognition of renal recovery, right? We may miss the fact that they're dry weights, we don't even recommend having dry weights for these patients, but their ultrafiltration goals will be different. You know, so the protocols for ESKD patient does not apply to a patient with AKI. So I think that diagnostic distinction is important for all aspects, not just for the regulatory, but also for the clinical care that we're providing.
And we're going to move into sort of the care of AKI in the dialysis unit. But before we do that, I just want to ask a question about billing. If a patient is deemed to be AKI dialysis, is there differences in reimbursement if you deviate from the once a week model and see them every day, for instance? Are those allowed to be billed on each one of those visits?
So the patients with AKI, the same code that you would use for inpatient dialysis, the 90935 code, is applicable to the outpatient dialysis setting as well. And so if you see them 3 days a week, CMS will allow you to bill for the 3 days a week visit. From the facility standpoint, the dialysis treatment is reimbursed the same equivalent to an ESRD treatment. And some of the drugs are bundled into that, just like for ESRD.
That's really great information. I appreciate that. Next thing we want to move is to You had alluded to a little bit about how the care in the outpatient dialysis facility is different. Let's talk about what the guidance recommends in as far as how a patient who's coming in, let's say if they're in that moderate or high risk of recovery, or even the low risk, what do you do differently in that dialysis unit and to assess for them maybe needing to be liberated from dialysis?
Right now, that was one of the concerns and why this guidance was created. Because right now we feel that patients with acute kidney injury are lumped into the ESKD protocolized management. So everybody gets the same treatment. They get a dry weight, they get protocolized EPO, iron management, bone and mineral disease management, and there's no assessment of renal recovery. So what this guidance is suggesting is that, first of all, recognize who the AKI patients are in your facility. Have a thorough education for the staff on why AKI is different from ESKD. Ensure that the nurses, as they're putting these patients on, are asking about increases in urine output. We are suggesting weekly labs, especially weekly 24-hour urine collection in addition to the BMP. And also, we are recommending not setting dry weights. The ultrafiltration goal for each treatment should be determined that day based on edema, blood pressures, increasing urine output. We're also suggesting that frequency of dialysis or intensity of dialysis be reduced as the renal function improves, as the urine output improves. Those are the big highlights.
Those are really great to hear, and I'm trying to understand how to implement these. And so the 24-hour urine would be sort of after their two-day break, is that right? You'd send them a jug, and then they'd bring that in, and how much they urinated, they'll have that information?
Yes. Traditionally, the 24-hour urines that are collected in, or the timed urine collections at a dialysis facility are done between dialysis treatments, so essentially a 44-hour collection for a patient on 4 hours dialysis. One of the more specific recommendations we made in this document was that it should be probably closer to a 24-hour collection and the 24 hours immediately preceding the next dialysis session. And this is probably one of the more nuanced recommendations, so I'm glad it's coming up. And it's based on the literature that suggests that immediately after dialysis, there can be some stunning of the kidney function. And so if you start a 24-hour urine collection right after dialysis, you may underestimate the amount of residual function there may be because it may be delayed due to the dialysis. And so again, one of the recommendations we made was to do that 24-hour collection immediately preceding the next dialysis session.
We also wanted everybody to learn a relatively new term called dialytic trauma. So dialytic trauma is a term that has been used in the critical care literature to talk about the effects of dialysis on distant organ effects of dialysis, including on the kidneys. And it refers to the ischemic injury and potentially other inflammatory injury from exposure to an extracorporeal circuit that can delay renal recovery and maybe even cause distant organ injury in other parts. We have used the term dialytic trauma in this guidance to make everyone understand that more dialysis or more intense dialysis is not safe and maybe even harmful.
Would that also mean to diminish the reliance on KT over V even?
I think that's a more challenging question, but the answer in our opinion is yes. I think you have to balance obviously adequate clearance with the risks of excessive dialysis. So we do give some KT over V recommendations, and these are based on the original ATN trial that was done many years ago in patients with AKI. So we felt that those recommendations were reasonable to provide a baseline or floor for dialysis clearance. But I would agree, and I think this is true in end-stage kidney disease as well, to be honest, that we really need to see the patient in front of you and not just the number that the KT over V refers to. It's not a perfect metric. And even though it is a quality metric, so we do have to balance that as well. But less reliance on that is reasonable if we are using good clinical judgment.
Some of the things that you mentioned, one is basically not having a dry weight, which I think it sounds like allows the practice not to really take off a whole lot of fluid on these individuals who are recovering. Two, they're having residual kidney function that's being measured that could be incorporated in. Three, potentially even skipping some sessions because they're starting to have some recovery, and recognizing that and being okay with that is another important aspect to this. So these are really great guidances. Now, I guess the hard part is, and this is where the challenge is, when do you know to stop?
So one thing that we have suggested, again, is the ATN study criteria for holding dialysis, which is a creatinine clearance of greater than 12 mL per minute. You know, an ongoing study is even suggesting stopping dialysis with a creatinine clearance of 8 mL per minute. So I agree with you that we don't have a set number at this point. A lot of it has to do with how the patient is looking, how their electrolytes are looking, what's their volume status. But definitely if the clearance is above 8 and they are having adequate urine output, I would suggest holding dialysis and monitoring them, bringing them back for lab, and consider stopping within a week if they don't require additional dialysis sessions. We are also suggesting using high-dose loop diuretics to maintain that urine output.
We have all these quality metrics that are happening for the patients with end-stage kidney disease. Do you see any quality metrics being used to ensure that we're doing a better job with AKI?
I would love to get to that point, because to be at that point would mean that we would have good evidence basis to guide those metrics. Unfortunately, I don't think we're at that point. Having said that, I've heard rumors. The government has, CMS specifically, has looked at whether AKI in the hospital should be a safety metric and such. I think for a lot of reasons that hasn't happened yet, although it will be a reporting metric, I think, as early as next year. I could envision in the future a metric such as percentage of patients with AKI recovering. But as soon as I say that, I can see how challenging such a metric would be because of all the different factors that go into whether a patient recovers. And so I don't know if we'll get there, but I hope that we, as a field, work towards that, because again, that would mean a lot better understanding of what best practices are.
And what about home dialysis modalities and how that works into this? We've talked about hemodialysis quite a lot here. Any comment on that?
So in 2017, US laws allowed for us to treat patients with acute kidney injury in the outpatient dialysis facility. Prior to that, patients with AKI could not be treated there and get adequate appropriate reimbursement. So in the 2025 rules that just came out, peritoneal or home dialysis is now covered. But the question is, who qualifies or who are the right patients to do that? If you just got over an acute critical illness, you're debilitated, is PD catheter and doing home dialysis the right, you know, treatment for you? Especially if you don't have enough social support to help you through that. On the other hand, we know that PD is a lot gentler and may even promote renal recovery as opposed to doing intermittent hemodialysis. So the other thing is PD catheter placement is yet another procedure the patient will have to go through as well. And if they're going to recover in 2 weeks, is it worth the surgery? Is it worth the training to get patients home? So I think it's a great option. I'm glad we have that option here in the US, but I think we have to really think through carefully on who should qualify or who should be placed on home dialysis.
I'm really excited about the home dialysis option as well, but I'm terrified as to how to actually implement it. And I can say that even though we saw it coming, we have not implemented it in our system, even though we're a very strong home hemo and peritoneal dialysis center. I think, like Anita said, there's a lot of potential theoretical advantages with doing PD. But once again, I would say I would love to see this studied more and hopefully us getting good evidence as to how to implement this and what best practices may be, rather than a helter-skelter approach to this.
Yes, in our research priorities, we did highlight that studying peritoneal dialysis for this particular population is a high priority.
And at what point do you transition them to say, we've given enough time, you're now in stage kidney disease and you're in the new protocols for those quality metrics and dialysis in the unit?
So typical cutoff is 90 days. That doesn't mean that you have to change somebody at 90 days or you can't do it before 90 days. And I think that's where that prognostic table comes into play, right? If you think the patient has a high likelihood of renal recovery, you're not going to change them to a diagnosis of ESKD at 30 days. However, if the patient has a low likelihood for renal recovery, they had severe advanced CKD at baseline, they already had a fistula placed prior to, you know, even having the AKI, then those patients could potentially be transitioned to the diagnosis of ESKD even at, you know, 30 days, right? And this will allow them, as Michael said earlier, to get the benefits of ESKD, including transplant referrals and maybe even transition to home dialysis, although that's not a problem anymore now. So I think it really depends on the clinician judgment and also physician-patient discussion as well.
And the last question I have is, what specific differences or statement that you'd like to make about pediatrics in this scenario?
We actually had two pediatric nephrologists representing. Really important to take care of the kids. And I think, honestly, we had a lot of similarities between the adult and the pediatrics, one of which, unfortunately, is the similar lack of strong data and evidence basis. But one of the things that perhaps has been better studied in pediatrics has been the use of volume monitors in hemodialysis to prevent dialytrauma, as Anita alluded to earlier. So I think that's one thing that came out in the pediatric section in particular, but a lot of the same principles in terms of monitoring, individualized care, careful avoidance of hemodynamic instability during dialysis, a lot of those things were quite similar actually between the pediatric and adult recommendations.
Okay, is there anything that we failed to cover that you want to mention?
I just want to highlight again that this is a very small population compared to the ESKD population, but yet they're very highly vulnerable population. They are forgotten when it comes to outpatient dialysis policy. So we, in our guidance document, we have this vision of what outpatient dialysis for AKID should look like in the US. And hopefully we can shoot for that if all the dialysis organizations partner on this.
I just want to say that I expect some people will challenge us on some of this guidance. We certainly had some debate within our group, although we were able to get to consensus for this. But I really hope people do challenge us, honestly, on these things. And I hope the way they challenge us is by going out there and getting the data to either prove that we're wrong or prove that we're right. Either way is fine with me, frankly. I think it would just be great to move this field forward so one day in the near future we're not, you know, so dependent on the expert opinions.
How big of an impact implementing this guidance can we make on patients who could recover? Like, do you have an idea about how many patients are probably could have recovered, but we failed to diminish this dialytic trauma? We failed to recognize that their urine output had improved. Just curious, what kind of impact can be made here?
I can give you an anecdotal experience from my fellowship. I remember a patient who came to our hospital after being on dialysis 1.5 years because she had mantle cell lymphoma and AKI and was labeled ESRD. She was on her way to getting dialysis, got into a car accident, broke her femur, injured her spleen, was airlifted. And then she told me the story of how she would get up in the middle of dialysis to urinate. And for 2 years, or I wanted to have 2 years, and nobody recognized that, right? And I took her off dialysis. She stayed off dialysis. Her GFR was only 12, but I took her off. But I think we're missing a lot of patients like that still. Patients who don't have the enough education to ask questions of their nephrologist to say, hey, I'm making a lot of urine. Can I come off dialysis? I don't know those numbers, Matt, but I think even getting one patient off dialysis should be sufficient.
I would completely second that. I don't have a number to guess either, but honestly, even one that we're missing is too much. Because in my mind, what's more important to a patient on dialysis than the opportunity to get off dialysis, right? We've seen studies where some people equate being on dialysis being worse than death, even from a quality of life perspective. And so for these patients where there's a chance by definition of them coming off dialysis, I think we owe it to them as a field to do everything we can to make sure we give them the best chance to come off.
Is United States Renal Data Systems tracking any numbers on this? We should have the codes for people that are coming in. And do we have any data, or can that be part of this process to improve the data?
Well, this definitely brings us back to the policy question. And the short answer is no. And this is a really frustrating part of things. So the USRDS is Medicare data. So it really is, the only reporting requirements are for end-stage kidney disease. So yes, there are some patients that are already Medicare eligible that will get AKI. And so we can access some of that data through CMS. But the vast majority of patients are not necessarily going to be on Medicare already, and they don't have routine regulatory reporting requirements. So by analogy, anybody that is designated end-stage kidney disease needs to have a form 2728 filled out, which gives some nice baseline information. And we've learned a lot from that form itself, just the data on that form with our dialysis population. There is no equivalent right now for acute kidney injury intake into the dialysis unit. And that's part of what Anita was alluding to with our recommendations for a warm handoff, to have that kind of important information. But even that is for clinical purposes. Having that on a large-scale data collection method would be even better, so we could have that kind of data. And to further extend that analogy, when you look at our end-stage kidney disease population, we have Crown Web reporting for dialysis treatments. We have no data, no publicly available data on how patients with AKI are being treated in the dialysis unit, which would be really helpful to try to identify different treatment factors that may be associated with better or worse kidney recovery. And then lastly, with end-stage kidney disease patients, when they transition away either to death or to a transplant, there's another designation in the system to designate what happens to the end-stage kidney disease patients. And we don't have that for AKI either. And so we don't know with high reliability what is happening to these patients at present.
You know, I strongly believe there has to be some quality metric similar to the QIP metrics that ESRD patients have that we should be tracking for AKID. One of that is recovery, right? How quickly did they recover? And, you know, or how many, what percentage recovered? And none of these is being tracked.
Seems like one quality metric might be just to track it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if you just track it, it doesn't matter what your outcomes are, but we just need some information.
Yes.
You know, all nephrologists, and thank you for sharing that story, have a story like that. And it just, you know, to me, it's hard to imagine in 2025, we, the experts that are here on this podcast with me, cannot answer that question. Tells me that we really have a lot of work to do in this area. Well, thank you so much to both of you for coming on and talking about this important issue. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did as well. Thanks for joining the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us. And thank you for highlighting AKI.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition, or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.